Well, I will start by praying for us. God, thanks for this night. Thanks for this week. Thanks for the chance to come together as a community, to look into your word together. Thanks for providing this place for us to come where we can be with each other, where we can grow together. Pray that you do something among us tonight, and pray that this would be a night of hope, that we would be seeing this church that is suffering, and that we would understand something of what your purpose behind it might be, and that we could understand a little bit about that in our own lives as well. And God, as we start to look into your word, I just pray that you'd kind of center us, that you would calm our hearts, whatever it is that we are coming from, work and busyness, the week of whatever it's been, hard stuff, good stuff, most of us probably busy stuff. Just pray that you would allow us to slow down now and to reflect and invite you to work in us through your Spirit. We ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen. So we had our ski trip this weekend. A lot of us were up in the snow. Some of you took a very long time driving in the snow. So when I came back, I had this kind of recurring backache issue. And when I came back, it was probably the worst it's ever been in my life. Like the first two or three days, really?
My stomach hurt like crazy.
Yeah. So the first two or three days, like, I literally was just in pain all the time. And for me, when my back hurts, it's like my lower back. And if I sit down for a while, then when I stand up, I have to do this for like a couple minutes until I can finally like walk straight and straighten up. So the point of this is that I was experiencing pain because of my back. And because of that, it caused me to do things that I didn't normally do. Okay? So for instance, Monday, I came home from work for a little bit. I had a meeting in the evening, but I came home for a few hours. And as soon as I got home, I lay down on the floor for like an hour. And it was wonderful. I felt great after lying on the floor for an hour. But that's not normally what I do, right? On Wednesday, I was studying actually this passage tonight. And sitting in my chair, my desk had been painful. So I printed out the passage on a clipboard, and I got a pen that I could write with upside down, and I lay down on the floor in my office and with my little clipboard, and I studied this passage. So these are not normal activities for me, okay? But the point I want to make then is that the pain I was enduring caused me to do things that I didn't normally do, weren't regularly part of my rhythm. We're going to come back to that tonight a little bit. And think about how pain works for us, what we do when we're suffering, and particularly the lengths to which we will go to relieve our suffering. And we're going to look at this church that a letter is written to, and we're going to see what Christ tells them about their situation, about how they're responding to their suffering. So the basic question tonight kind of has to do with, what do you do when it's hard? What do you do when life's tricky when you're experiencing pain? And I want to just kind of start by asking that of you guys. Like, how do you handle pain? What is, not like, how should you handle pain, but how do you handle pain? Whether it's physical pain or emotional pain or relational pain, how do you, what are some of your coping mechanisms?
Sleep.
Sleep. Okay, good.
Sleep it off.
What's that?
Sleep it off.
Sleep it off.
Forget about it.
Okay.
TV,
nice.
Eat.
Cry, okay.
Go somewhere. Go away.
Yeah, like from the situation or just like escape?
Drive somewhere.
Drive away, yeah, okay.
Talk to people.
Go hiking,
that's cool.
I know some people who clean.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, you do. And make their life miserable. Okay. What else?
Throwing a temper tantrum.
Throwing a temper tantrum. I know some people in my life that do that. 5 of them are very adept at it. Anything else?
Well, so this is what we want to look at, is how this church experiences pain, what they do, and how Christ speaks to them. So just to kind of catch us up, we're looking at the 7 letters to 7 churches in Revelation. This is the 2nd of them. And if you recall, the book of Revelation opened up with the Apostle John, who's been exiled to the island of Patmos, and he has a vision there. And the person of Jesus appears to him in this visionary state, in this kind of spirit-filled state that he's in. And Jesus gives him messages to the 7 churches, which he calls lampstands. And we talked about the idea that these churches, the metaphor of lampstands, is commonly used because the lampstand in the temple was always lit and was something that signified the presence of God to the world. It was something that demonstrated this is where God resided. And so when Jesus refers to the churches as the lampstands, he's saying this is one of the functions that the churches play. They demonstrate the presence of God to the world. And Jesus writes letters to 7 of these churches to encourage them, to correct them, various functions. So this one is in Revelation chapter 2, verses 8 to 11, and it's in the city of Smyrna, which is kind of a fun word to say. So I'll read it to start. To the angel of the church in Smyrna, write, "These are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful, even to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt at all by the second death." So let's just make a couple of observations kind of at first. Each of these letters contain various aspects. Most of them contain some amount of praise for the church. Most of them start with, "You're doing this well," and most of them contain some form of rebuke to the church. Kind of, "You're doing this well, but you can grow in this area." This letter is actually unique in that there's no rebuke of these people. So this is the only letter of the 7 that contains no criticism at all. And in some ways, I think it's significant to realize that he's writing to a church here that's suffering, that's clearly in pain, and there's no rebuke. And I think that's kind of, as we get going, it's helpful to realize that, because I think our natural assumption is that when things hurt, something is wrong. Right? So you would think that if something's going wrong for them, if they're suffering, if they're pain, Jesus might say, "Well, you should do this, and things will get better." Right? And this is kind of, I think, natural. It's actually how our bodies work, right? The function of physical pain is to say, you know, if I put my hand in the fire, my body says, "That hurts, please remove it immediately." Right? Pain is an indicator that things are wrong, and that some form of, you know, you should address the problem somehow. But that's not the way it works in life necessarily. It's not necessarily the case that because you're suffering, because things are difficult, because you're experiencing pain, that something should be changed. So it's important to realize right at the front that this letter doesn't tell them to change anything. The basic message of this level is to endure. To endure with faithfulness. But there's a hope in that, and that's what we really want to understand. So we want to ask four questions to kind of get our minds around what this letter is about. We're going to ask, what are they suffering? What is the type of pain that they suffer? We're going to ask, how should they suffer? There are some instructions about what it means to suffer well in this letter. So we're going to think about that a little bit. We're going to ask the question, how long will they suffer? And the question, how long, is a repeated question throughout Scripture. It's one of the most powerful cries to God. You see it in the Psalms, you see it in the Old Testament, you see it in the New Testament. People in pain cry out, how long, O Lord, will this go on? That's the third question we're going to ask. The fourth question we're going to ask is kind of, so what? What does it lead to? What's the purpose of this suffering? Does it get anywhere? What's there in the future? And that's ultimately the kind of where we're going to land. So let's start off by looking at this question. What are they suffering? What is this church enduring? What are the specific circumstances they're experiencing? Well, verse 9 kind of summarizes this. It says, I know your afflictions. And this is kind of the general word. This is the word translated tribulation in a lot of translations. So it starts out by saying, I know that you're suffering something difficult. You are afflicted. You are in tribulation. And then there's two specific things that are mentioned. The first is poverty. And there's kind of a wordplay here a little bit. He says, I know that you're suffering poverty, yet in reality you are rich. So what he's saying is then this poverty is literal poverty, that they are lacking material possessions. And yet he's reminding them that they have a sense of spiritual wealth in the midst of that. So one of the reasons for this probably is that in this society, in the Roman world during the first century, if you were a Christian, if you kind of excused yourself from the Roman religious system, you were very much an outsider to the world of commerce and the world of kind of how the whole culture operated. So to be a Christian often made it very difficult to make a living. It often ostracized you. It meant you didn't know the right people or you weren't connected to the right people because they were all part of this Roman cult system. So a lot of the poverty that these people might have experienced was because they were not compromising. They were being faithful Christians. There are some other reasons they could be poverty. We don't know for sure that this is it, but there's a couple of descriptions throughout the New Testament of Christians being so generous in their giving that they'd actually kind of give themselves into poverty, that even in times of great struggle, the Christians in the New Testament were known for giving away what property and wealth they had. It's possible they started out as poor. Christianity certainly applied or appealed to some of the lower classes in society. But for whatever reason, this is one of their afflictions. Their afflictions is that they suffered in the kind of economically in this culture. Second affliction, though, is that he says, I know the slander of those, and so they lost esteem. And he says, the slander of those who call themselves Jews, and so they purport to be the people of God, and yet they're not. And they're slandering this community, and they're saying, you are, not important, you are not significant. So I want us to think about those two ideas, kind of what they suffer is esteem and poverty and persecution. And think a little bit about, for us, we certainly live in a very different culture. Being a Christian doesn't take us out of the economic machine that we live in. It sometimes causes us to be at a disadvantage, but not so much so that we're destitute or anything. But I want to ask a little bit, what's true kind of biblically in the New Testament is that to be a Christian means that you will suffer. To follow God means that you'll suffer. And this word used here for affliction, tribulation, there's kind of this general theological sense that the church is in an age of tribulation, of suffering. That one of the roles, one of the callings even of the church is to suffer. And that's something that I think is kind of hard for us to grasp, because we live in an affluent society, we live in a world where we have mostly the means to relieve any of the suffering that we experience. And yet there is a sense that we suffer, that things are broken, that our lives don't work. And we certainly
if you listen to us, by the amount we complain, we must be suffering something, right? We certainly talk like things aren't perfect. So we do know about suffering, and I'm convinced that the kind of call, the promise that Christians are to suffer is not necessarily just because we're going to be persecuted for being Christians. So we taught a passage in India talking about being persecuted as a Christian. And the person who was teaching it at the time was kind of said, well, we don't really know about this, but you guys do, because you're literally persecuted. And that's true. We don't know the type of persecution. You know, I've never been physically assaulted because I'm a Christian pastor. The people I was speaking to in India had. But I think I do know the persecution of being a Christian, of following Christ, of choosing a life that is sacrificial, that in some sense we do suffer. And this is important because sometimes we kind of deny that the Christian life is suffering. Sometimes we try to make it sound like it should be great. And if you just do it the right way, if you just read your Bible in the morning for at least this number of minutes, and if you just, you know, play by the rules and do this, then your life will be this glowing beacon of the joy of the Lord all the time. And there is joy, but the joy from the New Testament is joy in the midst of suffering. So I appreciate this passage because it takes honestly suffering. And I mean, I kind of resonate with this personally because I think, I don't know if you guys feel this way, but sometimes I look at non-believers and I just think, that looks kind of nice. I don't know if you ever feel this way. But you look at people who don't profess faith, who don't believe hard things, who don't have some call on their life to choose to sacrifice for the sake of others, and I think, boy, that's really attractive. You know, I kind of wish I were just a non-Christian and I could kind of, I don't know, do what made sense to me. Like, that, there's an appeal to that life. And so there is a sense, I think, as Christians, we suffer. So what do you guys think of that, though? In what sense do you guys suffer, either as a Christian or just in general? How does that resonate with you?
I definitely agree with you, Paul, because I feel like sometimes you just, you know, you want to do the selfish thing, but it's just like, you know, I do want to please God, and so I mean, in situations where we had this ugly thing happen with my kid's teacher, and it's like, she blasted us, it was really uncalled for, and like, you just want to blast her back, but I know, I mean, God was very much convicting me, like, conduct yourself in a manner worthy of me, and be a peacemaker, and take the high road, and have a humble heart, and it's just like, can I do that later? Like, you know,
right.
But it's the right thing to do, and I mean, I want to honor him, and that's how I do want to live my life, so
yeah.
Sometimes you just want to.
Yeah. Good, that's a good example. Other stuff?
I had a similar thought earlier this week. I watched the Charlie Sheen interview, and I was just thinking, like, he just goes, he just takes the human desire or whatever and just goes as far as he wants with it. And, like, initially as he's speaking, it's kind of like, wow, he does pretty much what he wants, you know. But then later, when you see him, more of his life and just what it looks like, I kind of got the sense that maybe that's not what I want. There's a sense of, like, there's a sense, it's kind of like almost deceptive.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I was reading, and very similar to yours as well. I have this colleague with whom I work very closely, and though she's very nice, she's also very annoying and self-righteous. And how can you be that at the same time? She is. She's well-meaning. She's just very selfish. And I was reading somewhere about the humble brag, the term the humble brag, like, oh, my size 2 pants are getting too large for me. Oh, must be tough. Right? Or like, you know, that kind of whatever. You say something to feel bad about yourself, but really it's like telling everybody how box bad is where. And this woman does this constantly, or not even so subliminally. Sometimes she'll just say, yes, I'm amazing. And I'm like, no, honey, you're not. But I have to keep it to myself. But again, I experience this on a more than daily basis, like multiple times a day with this particular woman. And having learned from my past work experiences, I now know that I just need to bite my tongue. And the other day, actually, she came to the staff lounge and she was like, Laura, you'd be proud of me. I was going to write this email telling them how I felt. And then I decided, no, I'm just not going to do it. And I was like, good for you. No shit, lady. But there was an instance, yeah, anyway, I can go on and on about how she does this all the time, but sometimes I wonder, like, is it a Christian versus non-Christian thing, or is it just a, this, like, somebody else spilled milk in the hallway, and she tells me, clean it up. I'm like, okay. So I go and clean it up, and she's walking past the bathroom and doesn't, like, get paper towels, doesn't offer to help clean it up, and I'm like, on my hands and knees, cleaning up somebody else's spilled milk. Like, no big deal. It's literally spilled milk. Don't cry about it. But this woman could, like, have offered to, you know, I just, and so I go, is it how I was raised that you just see a mess and you clean it up because, and you offer to help somebody else clean it up? Or is it, you know, sometimes I just don't know whether it's, like, a Christian versus non-Christian thing or just a
decency.
Yes, yeah. Be a kind person and help clean up.
Well, yeah, and certainly, you know, I want to kind of synthesize a couple of those things because I don't know if we all often think of it this way, but when we choose to do these things, we are choosing to endure a type of suffering, right? So in the case you mentioned, you're choosing to endure a certain amount of defamation, right? I mean, a certain amount of, you've been characterized a certain way or something, and you want to defend yourself, and you want to attack back, and you choose to endure this. Basically what they're enduring in this case, slander, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a very common thing, I think, where we actually choose to suffer loss of esteem or in some cases there is material kind of disadvantages. But this is what these people are suffering, and the instruction given to them then is how should they suffer? How do you endure these things? And this is key for us because, you know, we know we're supposed to, right? But how? Right? How do you do it? How do you actually, like, what do you do with that stuff inside of you? What do you do with the feeling of wanting to act out or wanting to lash out or kind of, where does that go? So, they get two instructions in verse 10. The first one is not to be afraid. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. The second instruction comes later in the verse. It says, be faithful, even to the point of death. And so I think these are helpful words to us to think about in terms of how do we address difficult things in our life. We are to suffer faithfully and fearlessly. Faithfully and fearlessly. And I like these words because they have two different time orientations, right? Fearlessly is the kind of forward-looking thing. So whatever it is you're suffering, maybe you're suffering loneliness, and the fearful response to be, what if I'm alone forever, right? The kind of looking forward thing. Or you're suffering boredom in your job, and you think, what if I never get another job? Or you're suffering, you know, a difficult situation, and you think, what if it never changes? Or what if you're, or there's the fear of things are going great, what if everything falls apart tomorrow? You know, I mean, basically, whatever the situation is, we can find a way to fear the future. If it's bad, it'll stay bad. If it's good, it'll get bad. If it's bad, it'll get worse. I mean, we're creative, right? We can figure out ways to fear the future. And so this is the first instruction, is do not fear. Don't worry about what you're about to experience. And so that gets us out of this kind of future orientation of what if, what might be. And then you're stuck in the present, and the instruction comes to say, well, how do you be in the present? And the present is to be faithful, to be where you are, to be faithful to what you know to be true in the present. And I think the kind of idea behind this is to don't violate your principles. Don't kind of be true to what you know, and don't change that just because you're enduring pain. So this is the example I started with, right? My back hurt. Now, I didn't really violate any principles, except I would have been really embarrassed if somebody, like, walked into my office while I was lying down and studying upside down.
But I did something that I wouldn't normally do because I was in pain. And this is what we do, right? Things start to get hard, and we do things we wouldn't normally do because we're not willing to suffer. And this is what this church is commended for not doing. They remain faithful even when things are hard. And this is just our natural instinct. When things are painful, we try to stop it. We try to do whatever we can to stop it. And when the pain gets intense, we start to throw out the types of boundaries or the types of wisdom that we would normally go by, right? So, I mean, that's kind of, I think, an example of this, and that's kind of the idea behind torture, right? Like, if I want to know something from you and you don't want to tell me, I will inflict pain on you until you change your mind. And now you will tell me what I want to know. You will act differently than you would without pain because I'm inflicting pain. So this is what we do. So kind of in the midst of this suffering, we are faithful and fearless. Rachel and I have been trying to eat more healthily this year. And so we've been doing this diet. And, you know, it's easy to kind of, you think, oh, I'm going to do this. And you make all these plans. And then you get there and you're like, man, do I want chocolate. And you forget about your plans to eat healthily, you know, like, the pain of not having chocolate can be really severe. And so,
I just don't get up.
Exactly. That's why I bought it. So I should have chocolate tonight as an object lesson, but I know there's no brownies tonight. But this is how we work, right? We all of a sudden throw everything out the window because whatever we're experiencing is hard. And that's what these people are praised for not doing, for staying faithful. And then they're encouraged by saying, answering this question, how long will they suffer? And so in verse 10, they're told very specifically, I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Now, it's pretty unlikely that this is a reference to a literal 10-day period, mostly because the book of Revelation at the beginning kind of introduced itself as a prophetic, visionary, symbolic genre. And all throughout the book, numbers have these kind of prophetic type meanings. And so 10 probably refers to a period of time that is not short, but not interminable, right? So this is not an insignificant amount of suffering. 10 days is, that's a pretty long time. It's not like, oh, I'll just, you know, grit my teeth, but it's not forever. And I think that's a helpful way to think about the, when we suffer pain, when we have to endure something. It's not going to be insignificant. It's not going to just go away tomorrow. But it's not going to last forever. And that's really what we need to hear. In order for us to be faithful, in order for us to not give in to kind of throwing off the things that would normally restrict us, we need to know that this is not going to last forever. There is an end to this, and it's going to be a reasonable end. So whatever it is you might be suffering or enduring, or you might suffer and endure one day, you need to know that this situation you find yourself in is not going to last forever. Things will change. This kind of reminds me of like the college finals mentality. You know, it's like you get to finals week and it's like Sunday night and you're trying to study. And what I would tell myself is, you know, Friday night, this is all going to be over and it won't matter anyway. You know, this pain I'm enduring now is going to end. And it's in a certain number of days and then it'll just be over and what happened happened and I'll get on with my life. And so we need to know this when we're during hard times. We need to know that there will be an end. In fact, God promises in 1 Corinthians 10, Paul says this, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, no temptation has seized you except what is common to man, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. So when you are tempted, he also will provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. So it's actually this promise that we will not experience something that we can't handle. So I think there's probably a general principle about when we go through hard times in that it's going to be harder than you want it to be, but it's not going to be harder than you can handle. It's going to be harder than you want it to be. 10 days is longer than I would choose to endure something. but it's not going to be harder than you can handle. And then the kind of final conclusion is, well, what does all this mean? Because even if suffering is limited, even if it's just a short period of time, I think something within us just gets really upset if we have to go through meaningless suffering, right? Purposeless suffering, if it's just random. I mean, I think this is why driving to Tahoe and taking 12 hours is so frustrating, because it's just annoying. Like, maybe God's doing something, but it's really hard to find the purpose in that kind of suffering. And so we need to know that the suffering is going to stop, but we also need to know that there's something behind it. There's a reason for it, that there's meaning behind it. And this letter is full of that. Jesus introduces himself as the first and the last. And this is kind of a way of saying that he is eternal. He is from the beginning and the end. He is outside of the normal kind of range of time that we think of. And then he introduces himself as saying he's the one who died and came to life again. He suffered the most, and then that was redeemed. And the instructions given to these people are that you will suffer persecution for 10 days, and then they are told, be faithful even to the point of death. Be willing to die like Christ died, and I will give you the crown of life. And this is the great irony of Christianity. The mystery of Christ is that life comes through death. That when you suffer and die on a cross and are humiliated and everything is taken from you, that in the end, you get everything. That Christ is raised, exalted. And that we, as we choose to be faithful to Jesus, as we choose to endure suffering, as we, as this letter says, go all the way to death, what awaits us is life. And that's why this whole thing that we believe in and try to believe in and sometimes doubt doesn't make sense to the world and sometimes doesn't make sense to us, because it doesn't make sense. I mean, death leads to death, right? No. Be faithful to the point of death and I will give you the crown of life. There's something on the other side of all this. There's something to look forward to. There is some hope. That is the surest part of the Christian faith, that there is something next. There is, this does lead somewhere. And so the suffering leads forward somewhere, but even in the midst of the suffering, there's a sense of something good happening. So Paul has a bunch of like crazy statements in his letters about how his suffering, he rejoices in it, and how his suffering actually brings him closer to Christ. And there's this sense of kind of intimacy with Christ that comes about through the pain that he experiences. And I know this in my own life, that there have been times where things have been really hard, and I would never choose those again, but there is a type of spiritual richness in those times that I haven't experienced when things go well. There's an intimacy with God. And I think what is unique about hard times is it kind of forces you to make a choice. Kind of forces you to say, I'm going to endure this suffering with God. I'm going to invite him into it. I'm going to complain to him and yell at him and ask him how long and insist that he make things better now. And I'm going to be in it with him. And by the very just nature of the intensity of the experience, it creates this bond, this connection. Or I'm just going to choose to face the situation and be mad at this person and slander this other person and become bitter about this, and I'm going to just forget about God. The pain is the same. I'm not sure that going to God makes it feel any better necessarily, but it's enduring it with companion, somebody who's with you, and it creates this intimacy that is something remarkable. So Peter has this to say about that. 1 Peter 4:12. He says, dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering, as though something strange were happening to you. This is the way we think, right? But this is so odd that things are hard. Well, no, it's not odd. That's kind of the way the world works. He says, don't be surprised but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ, that you actually are united with Christ somehow in the midst of this. And then he says, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. And so there's this sense of intimacy with Christ in the time of suffering, but also connection with Christ in his glory and exaltation, that this kind of newness, something will come.